Right, I'm going to try and pick my way around all the things which John and Martin have already talked about, and try not to contradict my wrong figures against their right ones too often, and just pick on four points of entry to discussion. I think which really strikes me about migration is people either talk with forked tongue about it, or they bite their tongues in relation to it, and that's something which hopefully this series is going to try and work on, try and get a sensible debate going on about the implications of migration issues in relation to this city, and start to unpick some of those. And the other thing that strikes me about migration is that the relationship between stocks and flows is not understood by anybody at all, including half the time by me, and it's very uneven, and all sorts of stupidities like the one about students seem to come out of the simple equations of grosses with nets. But beyond that, actually understanding the dynamics of how long people stay and under what circumstances do they come and go seems to me to be really important to the realities of this. Okay, so four things I want to talk about to take a very long view about London migration of the past 25 years. The past 25 years being when London turned the corner from consistent population decline to stability and growth. The significance of irregulars, the tier two revisited yet again, and the impacts of migration on the bottom end of the labour market. Talk about that. All of which I think are really important issues to follow up, not beyond the little things I'm going to say. So, 25 years, 87 to 2012, a couple of upsurges in the late 80s and 90s, overseas migration turned around population trends in London. I think that's one of the cases of biting of tongues. If you read JLA outputs, they don't say, actually, that the simple fact is that adult population has grown much faster in London than you could have imagined, simply because of migration. They always talk about births, but births tend to come from parents. The overseas-born population has risen over this 25 years quite remarkably from 1.1 million in what was thought of as quite a cosmopolitan city to nearly 3 million in this. And the share of the population has doubled, partly due to a 50% displacement of others. So flipping on to a chart. So if you look at net migration, net international migration and net domestic migration, you notice that one is a mirror image of the other, with a fluctuation which is typically about half the size. So my crude notion about how the population of London has contrived to grow without actually putting up many more dwellings is that twice as many people sleep in each bed, well, no, in each square metre or something like that. More people have been packed in, more people from poor countries have been packed in, specifically. So the population growth is not just that migrants have come in, but it's to do with how many people we fit into the space and how long we can sustain that, I want to suggest. Cosmopolitanism has grown enormously. So we now have, putting some other numbers into this, 56 national communities with over 10,000 in London. I updated my slides from two or three years ago, and it said 40 then. And it's despite the stability that John's talking about, this is stability in trends. And what it does to numbers actually produces remarkable increases perceived on the ground, and with implications that Max is going to talk about in terms of diversity in the workplace. There's now, on my version of the foreign-born, as many Poles as Irish and Indians, rather than racing along, and large West European groups, and I think that's as striking as anything else, the size of the French, German and Italian populations in London. It's not just exotic immigrants. Large inflows then from both rich countries, by which I mean North America, Western Europe, Japan and Korea, and from poor countries. But the really significant difference, I think, is that as a first approximation, people from rich countries go home eventually, people from poor countries don't go home. So the thing about it's not quite as crude as that, but it's much more like that than assuming there's the same duration. So the dynamics depends very much upon where people are coming from and basically along that dividing line, and treating Eastern Europe as part of the poor world in this respect. London gains disproportionately, we've heard that already, but it gains disproportionately in an uneven way across different groups. So it gains disproportionately except probably for people from Eastern Europe. So the A8s, I think London's had between 15 and 20% of the inflow, which is give or take its population share. On the other hand, in the heyday of unregulated asylum influx before 2000, on the limit, the single source of information I think we have on this from Home Office files, which have been applied to all sets of data after that, 80% or 85% of them came to London, right? Switching at 2000 once there was dispersal back to the 30% or so, which is our average for all influx. So very different amounts of influx between these different groups, shares. The A8 thing I think is interesting in relation to employers, because it seems to me that the single simple reason why London has had much less than its share is because migrants have been directed somewhere else by agencies. So the role of employers and their intermediaries has been really very important in this. And actually, if you look at the number of people who say they get an income from employment agencies currently, there's zero amongst Polish migrants in London in the last LMS, whereas there's 10% across the rest of the country. And what London has is a much larger proportion of self-employed Poles and East Europeans. So there's different kinds of processes, but it's one process which has largely left London out of it, which is why it's had a much smaller share. And the other thing to say, everybody knows that migrants are young, but tied up with that is the fact that they're pretty well educated. So the average migrant coming into London has been better educated than the average Londoner, and about as well in terms of quantity of education, if not the language of it, and as much education on the whole as young Londoners have, which is not simply reflected in what they do and the kinds of earnings they get out of it as a starting point. Right. Okay. Second thing I wanted to say something about and put back into discussion is the role of irregulars, which in some ways seems to be becoming a non-issue, but I think is actually something which is waiting to be revived. I mean, irregulars, as I understand it, is illegal migrants plus overstayers plus failed asylum seekers. So that's people who've been through all of the legal stages and still are resident in the country. On our estimates, which John was quoting, it was preponderantly the last of these. So our view, Christine's and mine and Kath's, I think, was that asylum seekers were preponderantly failed asylum seekers, and our view about all sorts of other characteristics of them follows on from that quantification. That they're the substantial remnant of a poorly managed influx around the year 2000. And the idea that this is a legacy goes back to this notion that once upon a time we couldn't handle migration, now we can, so we're dealing with the legacy of failure to deal with appeals more than anything else perhaps during that period. In 2009 we produced an estimate that there were about 600,000 irregulars in the UK as a whole, and that 70% of those were in London, which is one of the reasons why it's a London issue. And that was building on Home Office estimates of Woodbridge for 2001, and already allowing for about 170,000 regularised cases. So another thing about the biting of tongues has been the lack of publicity over the years about the extent of regularisation. Regularisation is something we don't do in this country, except when you look at the statistics and discover quite how many there have been, even before the legacy operation. And the other one case of that was during the UKBA's case resolution legacy programme from 2006 onwards, when all the statements that came out of the Home Office said, basically, we're not letting anybody through, only 30% of people get through, we're hardly regularising anybody at all, when the reality was that half of the cases were being dismissed as non-cases or put back in the filing cabinet. But UKBA's legacy programme should have eliminated the irregular problem either by regularising or getting rid of people physically out of the country. And it clearly has failed to do this. But how far it's failed to do this, it seems to me, is quite uncertain. So they've now come somewhat clean and admitted that there's 124,000, I think it is, that they've admitted to, cases that they simply couldn't trace. That seems to me about half of the number that are really a mystery about this, because they claim that others have simply died, gone away spontaneously, or been regularised without actually being counted anywhere. That may be true, but they haven't produced any evidence of this. So it's quite unclear as a result of this. Firstly, where it leaves all the work which we did in 2009. I mean, if UKBA are right about what happened to these people, then our numbers are off the wall somewhere. We don't quite know who the irregular population were at the time, how many of them there were. We should admit that. But also, it leaves us quite unclear how many irregular people there still are in the country. And I think that matters. And it seems to me that it matters because, well, our interpretation in 2009 was that in the past, under an old, fairly liberal regime which didn't take a great deal of account of a lot of things, irregularity accumulated quite a wide spectrum of effective regularity. There were lots of people who passed almost 100% or 50% or 20%. They could get a lot out of the system. We thought that about 50% of adults were in work, and that there was only a gap of about 6% in employment rates amongst this group that you could attribute to them being irregular, and that probably they paid 50% of their due taxes. Now, these are hairy estimates, but still they suggest quite a high degree of regularity. Under the new regime, the regime being introduced under New Labour and by this government, this is clearly increasingly ceasing to be the case, that there is this great grey area in which people can pass as easily. So it seems to me that we need to know an awful lot more about the numbers of and the position of this group below the horizon, the people who are irregular but not supposed to be here any longer, who presumably are much more in the real black, in the real black economy, in the real shit, you might say, than their predecessors were. Because I think it's still the case that 70% of them are likely to be in London. And 70% of 112,000 or 70% of a quarter of a million is a lot of people in a very marginal, difficult situation that I think we have to look at more closely. Right, thirdly, it's hardly anything to say about Tier 2 that hasn't been said by either John or Martin, except maybe something about where people came from. Which has something to do with the differences also between intra-company transfers and others. So overall, the striking feature is that 55% of Tier 2 admissions in the years we looked at, 2009-2011, were from India. Right? 13% from the United States, and then the tail of countries with 2-3% in this. 55% because 75% of those who came in as intra-company transfers, many of them in IT professions, actually were from India. And I think partly representing a source of relatively cheap labour for those professional jobs, as well as people who were being trained up. So this is an interesting thing, and it has some relevance to the dynamics. Intra-company transfers are the unquoted part of this picture, but they're the time limited part of it. In principle, none of these people should be here for more than 3 years. Some of them should be here for significantly less than 1 year. Other people have more faith in immigration administration than I do, and the expectation that people will necessarily go away. But in principle, these are strictly time-limited admissions. There's a very strong concentration, as John pointed out, and I think Professor Martin pointed out as well, within the Greater Southeast. In terms of travel to work areas, there's all these areas in capital letters are within the Greater South East. There isn't much difference between London and a series of other areas, notably Reading, Ipswich and so on, in terms of the density of these groups. They're not very high anywhere, they're less than 1% within it. But there are very few areas in the rest of the country, only Edinburgh and Aberdeen appearing in as having significant concentrations of these groups. So it's a Greater South East phenomenon, and specifically, the one thing within London is the City of London, Tower Hamlets, i.e. Canary Wharf, as workplace locations, stand out above anywhere else in the country. But still, it's only 3% or so we're actually talking about. But if you look at the general geography of this, it's clearly very much associated with what kinds of industries there are in the place. Right, so it's very largely shaped by where there's concentrations of IT and financial service employers, and to some extent by the size of the city. It's not a particularly London effect. So it doesn't seem as though it reflects any particular responsiveness to peculiar needs or priorities of London employers, just some generic tasks which are attracting lots in. Lastly, since time must be running out, say just a little bit about migration at the bottom end of the labour market. The tier two is clearly about the top end of the labour market. I think the research consensus has been that in-migration doesn't have negative effects for the average worker, but that it doesn't lower average earnings or employment rates, but Christian Dustman and others, I think, have suggested that this may not be true at the bottom end of the labour market. One of the reasons why it may be different at the bottom end of the labour market, I think, is because new arrivals from poor countries in quite large measure get crowded into jobs at the bottom end of the labour market, despite their relatively high levels of education. You can't see this, I don't think, but this compares migrants from high-wage countries in London, low-wage countries, the years in the UK, less than 3 years, more than 3 years. What we see is that migrants from low-wage countries in their first 3 years here, 40% of them are in jobs in the bottom quintile in terms of pay nationally in the country. After that, it's up down to about 24%, right? And there's a very clear progression over the years, so 40 years on, they've more or less got back to their true position. It's a process of change which is quite rapid here. But it does mean that in the few years after peak rates of inflow from low-wage economies, there is this crowding of extra workers into the bottom end of the labour market. And comparing London with other regions, we think we've got good evidence that in the boom of migration from low-wage economies between 1995 and 2005, more or less, lowered wages in the bottom quintile by, it says here, X percent. It's a number more like 15% than anything else, which I failed to check just before I came out, but certainly upwards of 10%. So a really big downward shift in wages. That this in turn stimulated a growth of jobs in this bottom quintile in London during that period, for which, again, I think we have clear econometric evidence, but I'll show you a graph in a moment which is, I think, convincing in itself, and not quite so convincing that beyond this, that the impact of the lowering of wages was to raise inactivity, that it discouraged people from seeking work in the city. And just so this is what happened to real earnings in the bottom quintile. That's London. This is all the other regions of the country. Right? So you can see in this era something quite distinctive happened to London earnings in the bottom quintile between roughly 1995 and 2005. They went down almost to the level of other regions, and then they recovered after that significantly. So in this coinciding with the overall boom in overseas migration, but particularly that in migrants from poor countries, so far as we can estimate it, that employment in the bottom quintile seems to have responded quite clearly to the lower wages and went up and then down again over the same period. And the thing which is not quite so clear-cut, these are graphs of the difference in rates of worklessness between London and the rest of the Greater South East, areas which have got roughly the same pressure of demand factors as London. The blue line at the top here is total worklessness. Maybe we should ignore that. The green line is unemployment, which shows some convergence, but no dramatic change over the years. This is inactivity. Give or take the jaggedness, what this shows is a gap in inactivity which emerges and widens over this period of migration boom and then shrinks down again. Right? And this is, when you look at LFS figures, this is predominantly in people saying not only that they're not looking for work, but they don't want work. This period, right? So there's an increase in that numbers, which seems a rational response to what's happened to the wages in the kind of jobs that many of them might expect it to have had access to. I think we need a more open debate.